And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we talk about ancient civilizations, mysteries. Christopher Dunn with us and Mr. Brian Forrester. He'll be live in Peru, so stand by. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Two special guests for you tonight. First of all, of course, a Coast to Coast regular, Christopher Dunn. Christopher's Pyramid Odyssey began in 1979 after he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. His immediate reaction after learning of the Great Pyramid's precision and design characteristics was to consider that this edifice may have an original purpose that differed from conventional opinion at the time. Discovering the purpose of this machine, documenting his case, has taken the better part of 20 years of research. Welcome back to Coast, Christopher Dunn. Christopher, welcome back.
Hello, George. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Likewise, I'm looking forward to this. And of course, Brian Forrester, born in Rochester, Minnesota, but grew up on the west coast of Canada at the age of 11. He became fascinated with the native art of the Haida native people and began carving totem poles and other related art forms, and learning from native teachers in Peru and the study of the Inca culture became his next major area of interest. Here's Brian Forrester. Hello, Brian. Nice to have you with us.
Absolutely my pleasure, George. Thank you.
And you're out there in Peru right now, are you?
Yes, sir. I'm in Lima right now.
How are things out there for people who have never been there, Brian?
The weather is quite wonderful in Lima. I was actually in Cusco yesterday for about a week, and there it's more like Vancouver kind of weather. It's kind of rainy, but it's green and lush, and it's the land of the Inca, so I love it very much.
Well, good. You're sounding clear, and it's good to have you with us. And Christopher, always a pleasure to have you on the show, my friend.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, George.
And your theories of the Giza power plant still, I think, keeps people baffled. I mean, let me ask you very briefly, Christopher, how did you come up with that theory?
It was actually, you know, it was Tompkins' book and the questions that were raised by a lot of earlier researchers. And it seemed that the common thread that ran through a lot of the earlier explorers and researchers, that it was to question the original purpose that has been taught by Egyptologists, that it was built as a tomb. And so there were a lot of different ideas presented in this book. And the book ended with a huge question mark. And that question mark was, what actually was the Great Pyramid? Will we ever be able to figure it out? And as I was researching and reading the book, a light bulb came off or came on over my head, and it was quite a radical idea that I pursued for over 20 years, and then finally published my theory in the Giza Power Plant in 1998. But it took a lot of time, a lot of research, and a lot of study and thought about the different elements within the Great Pyramid. And so, for that, it was a very satisfying and really right now, as we are 12 years down the road from when the Giza power plant was published. It doesn't seem to have slowed down as far as the amount of interest in it and the supporters of it. And indeed, as we may talk later, the evidence keeps rolling in that to actually support the theory. And other research that other people are engaged in also support the theory. So who knows? I mean, one of these days we may be able to get to turn it on.
Maybe so. And what are your thoughts, Christopher, on Zahi Hawass's fall from grace?
I think in that area of the world, it's not an unusual event. I'm surprised that he was able to last as long as he did. But then when you consider how close he was to Mubarak, particularly Mrs. Mubarak, then it's understandable because it's more of connections and politics. But as far as what that will do in terms of the archaeology, or at least the popularization of discoveries, and the broadcasting of Discoveries. He was a great showman, and he certainly kept things stirred up and entertained and also angered a lot of people in the process.
Yeah, that's so true, so true. Let's bring Brian back in. Brian, tell me about your work in Peru.
Well, basically, my work started, my interest started about 6 years ago. As you said, I was fascinated from childhood with the native people of the west coast of Canada. I became a professional totem pole carver and carver of other objects. When I was about 35, I moved to Hawaii and helped build a 62-foot double-hull sailing canoe, traditional. And then returned to Canada, and for some reason about 6 years ago, I became fascinated with the Inca and Machu Picchu, so I came down to visit, and it just grabbed my attention, and I've been coming to Peru ever since, having moved here June of last year.
Ian, what can you tell us about the Inca, Brian?
Well, the basic story is that the Inca left the area of Lake Titicaca about 950 AD as the result of a 40-year drought. And so traditional archaeology says that they established Cusco about 1100 or 1200 AD. But the more that I do research, the more that I'm finding the case is similar to in Egypt, where some of the structures in Cusco, the stone buildings, especially those that you can't fit a piece of paper or a human hair in between the joints, are probably thousands of years older than the Inca. And the more that I study the oral traditions, the more evidence that I'm finding that that was the case.
How did the Inca differ from the Maya, if at all?
They're completely separate cultures. There's no real relationship between the two.
None at all. Okay. No similarities, nothing like that?
No. No, not really.
Okay. In your work in Peru, and, you know, it is, I have been told, just a fascinating place. When you look at the structures that they've got, and much like, of course, when we'll talk with Christopher about Egypt later on as well, how do you think they made these structures?
Well, the theory that I'm developing more and more is that the Inca, when they reached Cusco, that Cusco was actually an abandoned city. And that's what intrigued them, because it seemed more logical to me that they would build their city in the nearby Sacred Valley, because it's much more productive in terms of agriculture and the climate's better. But what I think, based upon my recent trip with Dr. Arlen Andrews, is that they had like an intuitive knowledge or an ancestral knowledge that Cusco was the homeland. And as they approached the city of Cusco, they found this massive megalithic gate, and the road between Lake Titicaca and Cusco had already been there for probably thousands of years prior to their existence. And so they simply entered Cusco and were in awe of the fact that there were these huge quadrangular or buildings made out of stone, where the stone fits so well together that, like I say, you can't fit a human hair in between them, and they're still intact today.
So what about... I'm sorry, Chris. Go ahead. Brian.
So they decided to establish their city there because that is the city that the ancient people, the ancient megalithic builders, had built.
What about tools, Brian?
Well, that's the funny thing. Conventional archaeology states that, and it's proven in the archaeological record, that the only tools that the Inca had were bronze chisels and stone hammers. And again, buildings such as the Coricancha, which was not only the spiritual center, but also the political center of the Inca, is so finely made that you, again, can't fit a human hair in between. And it's impossible for them to have built that building with bronze chisels and stone hammers.
There's no way, but any idea how they did it?
Well, the more that I share photographs with people like Chris and with Stephen Mailer and with other experts, The theory that we're starting to develop is that they had some kind of vibrational technology several thousand years ago that we don't even have today. So it's very much an out-of-the-box kind of approach.
Chris, are you at that point where you believe this too?
Well, I think from my visits there, and of course I have been fascinated with South America for many years, and I finally had the opportunity to go there in 2005 with David Hatcher Childress, a good friend of yours.
Yes.
And so in 2005, when I visited Cusco and went along the Passage Agua Pinta, it was kind of an alleyway by a monastery, and saw some of the megalithic stones. That was my first encounter with the difference in the architectural styles, where you have the megalithic construction, where the stones are multifaceted and fitted together with great precision, just as Brian said. But then when you look at the repairs that were made, they're very primitive. I have some photographs up on my website if folks want to click on the link Mysteries of Peru and Bolivia Revealed. Then they can go through and look at some of those photographs. But you'll see the differences in style, where you have the what seems to be the earlier culture, what would be the earlier culture, and then the primitive or rough kind of repairs that have been made. But then as you go through all the other different sites in Peru, such as Ayantitambo and even Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman, you see the lower portion of the construction is made out of these huge megalithic blocks, finely fitted, and then on top of them you have the smaller elements, the size that you may find in a modern building, just put together like a dry stone wall in some cases, and in Cusco, which I believe the repairs are more modern, they use some kind of a mortar between the stones, which the Inca didn't use, or the pre-Inca, as we are now coming to believe. We're not using any mortar between the joints because the stones were so perfectly fitted together.
So you're saying, though, that the earlier civilizations were more advanced than the later ones?
It's the same story in Peru and Bolivia that we find in Egypt. And that is that the ancient cultures were able to do really remarkable work with a high degree of precision, using multi-ton, over 100 tons in Peru and Bolivia, and over 1,000 tons when we go to Egypt. But the geometry and precision in Egypt is not quite the same in Peru. You do have the megalithic construction with the finely fitted joints, but it's not till you get to Bolivia that you start to see the geometric precision that is the hallmark of Egyptian construction. So in Peru, though, I mean, it's a beautiful place to go. I was really inspired by going there, and I actually went back in 2011, and it was even more inspiring then because, you know, one of the things that I try to do is to connect with the ancient culture in some way. I'll try to get inside the ancient stone maker's head and say, okay, what were you doing here, guys, you know? and you know, attempt to figure out exactly how they were making these structures. And so The last trip I had, it was quite inspiring to me because I think I was kind of tuning into perhaps some of the methods. I mean, everybody has a theory. There are all kinds of theories out there. But the interesting thing that I noted was that particularly at Sacsayhuaman, it appeared to me that the area, there was a massive upheaval you have an extrusive mound or extrusive rock that actually pushed up through the bedrock. They call it the Inca Slide, and there are deep gouges on this slide. They're quite smooth because for centuries people have been using it to play on. I mean, if you go there today, you'll find children sliding down it. Even old children like Brian and myself. But the Inca Slide, I think, actually gives us an indicator of perhaps where the blocks came from to build the megalithic structure. If you consider that if this extrusive rock was pushing up through the Earth's mantle and then breaking through the bedrock, then it could have broken off pieces that would be fitted together like a jigsaw puzzle. So it's a matter of just blowing up a jigsaw puzzle, and then what they did was put the pieces together to build the walls. That's just an idea. It would actually simplify the problem of actually making this thing, because what you find with all the joints is no two blocks are the same. Common to all the blocks is that they're not built like a modern building where you have essentially layers. So, you know, you may have a layer of stone that is horizontal, which that form of construction could shake apart in an earthquake. But the Inca construction, all the stones seem to be interlocking in such a way that they can't move. I mean, if you were able to push a wall one way, in one direction, the stones would stick together. Or you know, if you try to pull it apart, they're bound together by their geometry and by their precision.
Amazing. And Brian, let me ask you this: when we talk about lost cities, how many are we talking about? Do we know?
Well, we don't really know. Of course, people think of Machu Picchu as the lost city, which it was, because the Spanish never found it. But there's another one called Choqquequirau, which is less than 100 miles away, and it's not quite as big as Machu Picchu, but almost the same size. The Spanish didn't find it. People have been looking for more than 100 years for a place called Paititi, which they think was the place where the Inca were able to hide most of the gold prior to the Spanish conquest. And no one so far has found it, except last week when I was there with Arlen Andrews, our taxi driver, who happens to be a Quechua person, a native person of the area. He said he knows where it is, and he said he would take me there.
How about that? Well, that's fascinating stuff. Now, when you go to these areas, how do they get lost? Vegetation just overtake them?
Basically, the thing is that any lost city is probably somewhere on the ancient Inca road system. So Machu Picchu, for example, is on a side route off of one of the major, what would have been one of the major Inca highways. So a lot of people are thinking that deep in the Amazon somewhere there would be this, you know, shining city. But you have to take into account the material. Cusco and the Sacred Valley, and even around Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, you know, there is a lot of stone. So you could build, many giant stone buildings, whereas in the Amazon, you don't have that much stone. So I'm looking more closer to Cusco and the Sacred Valley area for signs of ancient lost cities.
All right, hold on, Brian. We're going to be back with you and Christopher Dunn in just a moment as we talk about these ancient civilizations right here on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, our two special guests tonight, Christopher Dunn, Brian Forrester, their works you can find on their websites, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And we shall be back in a moment as we continue talking about ancient civilizations. Chris, after studying Egypt for so many years, what got you to turn your attention to South America?
You know, that's a very good question. I always wanted to go to Machu Picchu. I thought that was, that fascinated me. And the only photographs that I'd seen were the famous ones of Machu Picchu and other sites like Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo. My thoughts was that I probably wouldn't find the same degree of craftsmanship there that I would in Egypt. So it wasn't a real passion of mine to go. I was interested in going, and when I had the opportunity, I took it. And so I was very surprised with what was found there, what I was able to see there. But at the time I went, it was with Dave Childress, and we were actually making a video. And, of course, David, he was hot on the trail of ancient machining in Peru and Bolivia. And so we were going around on, checking these different artifacts, and there were checking, these stones, and mm-hmm. I wasn't finding the same precision, the same geometric precision. And so when he asked me the question, well, don't you think this has been machined? And I would answer, well, that's not the best evidence to actually support such an idea. And so we'd move on to another site, and so the question was the same at every site. Well, obviously this has been machined, and I am probably more conservative than a lot of people in this field, and I was very hesitant to actually come out and say positively that they had to have used machines to do this. Now, one of the things that I do believe, though, I became aware of that, was that they were obviously moving very heavy blocks around, megalithic blocks, with relative ease, much like the other ancient cultures, like in Egypt or in Lebanon at Baalbek. Mm-hmm. That part of it, to me, was of great interest. And, if you look at some of the megalithic blocks at Sacsayhuaman, and you see the way they are so tightly fitted, you have to wonder how were they lifting these up? How were they trimming them to fit? Because if they were using simple hand tools, and they would have to actually put a block on top of another one and fit it together, take it off again, trim it off where you have the high spots so that you remove the imperfections until you finally get a perfect fit.
And put it back on again.
Do that, and then put it back on again. And how often would they have to do that? And when you look at the size of these stones, it seems almost impossible to believe that a primitive culture, a simple culture, without the tools, without even the technology that we have the way we lift megalithic elements, it seemed almost it would be an impossible mission. And the conventional theory about how the supposed Incas built this place is that they used mud ramps. I mean, they don't even allow them the benefits of using log rollers, because it is a high elevation, and trees are not very plentiful, and perhaps according to conventional wisdom, they hadn't figured out how to use a wooden roller, but they use these earthen ramps and drag the stones into place.
Are you familiar, Christopher, with the work of Edward Leete Scullin from Coral Castle?
Well, George, I'd have a full chapter on Edward Leete Scullin in my book, The Giza Power Plant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only man, in modern times anyway, to say he knew how the pyramids of Egypt were built and actually perform some work that proved that he was probably right. Ed was an eccentric. He was from Latvia. Latvian immigrant, and essentially he lived alone in Florida, South Florida, at a homestead, and he built this castle out of coral. He was moving 30-ton blocks of stone, coral, and nobody, he wouldn't allow anybody to watch him work. He was very, very reclusive, very secretive about, and there's lots of legends about, and, you know, anecdotes about how people were peering over the wall and seeing him float stones in the air. And, but, you know, those are kind of, that's, you know, kind of the, it's not very, it's not the best evidence, you know, to just have an oral kind of, interesting legend about somebody. But he was definitely mysterious. I think that Ed Lee Scanlon had developed a technique that alleviated the effects of gravity on heavy objects and was able to do it with relative ease. And I think that when he said that that's how the ancient Egyptians did it, how he was able to make that connection, I don't know, but he certainly was able to demonstrate something. We have the results of what he did. He didn't demonstrate it to anybody, but the results definitely would indicate that this guy knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, he may have had those secrets. Yeah, I do too. Is it possible? Let's get you, Brian, and you, Christopher. Is it possible that they had high impact lasers, which allowed them to cut the stone, Brian?
Well, the thing is that Chris has proven that that isn't the case, because he actually showed it on Ancient Aliens. He took a sample of ancient stone, and he did a comparison test of cutting with a laser, cutting with a grinder, and then also having the original surface. And he did a microscopic study of that, which is available on Facebook to look at. And lasers actually melt stone, but they make a complete mess. The mystery about the megalithic builders of Peru is the fact that all of the cuts are very clean, and any place that where you find a 90-degree angle, there's actually a curve. So these huge cubes of stone, some is the size of refrigerators, are literally cut out of solid bedrock, and some of them even appear to be polished, or at least the surface is so clean that I can't figure out, and I've never found anybody who can figure out how the stone was removed. But lasers are not a candidate.
Okay, Chris, as you look at that with you know, getting lasers out of the picture, they must have had something. They had to have had something.
Yes, they had to have had something, and you know that's what the mystery is. What kind of tools did they have? And you know, as far as the laser is concerned, that has been a popular theory for so long. And having been involved in high energy laser processing in my work for many years, I took the opportunity. Brian sent me a piece of a stone. The same kind of stone that you would find at Pumapunku, and it did have an ancient cut on it, and it's posted on my website, and you can see the differences in the cuts. And the cut that the laser did, it's not conventional cutting. It's more burning, because it is a thermal process.
Right.
And it actually turns the surface into glass. You have it melts it, but then you have a remelt layer and a heat-affected zone, which is a signature of thermal processing, like with laser or plasma arc and things of that nature. So it's a thermal process, pure and simple. And you don't produce the same kind of surface with it that you do with conventional tools. Now, the other part of that is that a laser works better if it's penetrating completely through the material. And you can't stop the laser. I mean, you can stop it just by not having enough energy to penetrate the laser, but then you don't get anything but blobs on the surface of the material that you're working with. But you can't stop it. I mean, you can't really set a depth So when you look at some of the cuts that you find in Peru, Bolivia, in Egypt, and you see these cavities that are cut or corners, when a laser is put to work, it has to pass right through the material. Otherwise, it's not efficient.
Well, let's assume for a second that the technology, the lost technology, we'll get into why it may have been lost, but that it was similar then in different regions of this planet a long, long time ago. How can we explain that? The fact that it was happening in Egypt, it was happening in Peru, possibly Bolivia, maybe Lebanon. It was planet-wide. How come, Christopher?
Well, I think that, you know, just like today, there is a cross-pollination of technologies, ideas that move from culture to culture. I don't agree with the conventional theories that these ancient cultures were not communicating with each other. I mean, you just see some of the Negroid heads that you find in South America and some of the other different shaped skulls that Brian has studied. And you can see that there is a wide variety of different peoples that were migrating or, you know, in transit through these different places. We, as engineers, go all over the world and lend our skills to different places, building and actually teaching. That's how technology has flourished, and why now a lot of the technologies that we developed in the West were adopted in Japan and China and around the Pacific Rim. And so the manufacturing genie is out of the bottle, and everybody can manufacture now, whereas at one time all the manufacturing technologies were closely held secrets.
All right. How about your thoughts, Brian? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
No, that's fine. Brian certainly can add to that.
Well, the thing is that a number of people have sent me photographs, especially from the west coast of Italy, where the Etruscans used to live. And you see the same thing. You'll see these large, these huge boulders or even bedrock exposed stones where you have stairways that seem to go nowhere. And they look almost exactly the same as what we see in Peru and to some extent Bolivia. And so I definitely believe there was a global culture, possibly a pre-Ice Age ending culture that existed around the world. David Hatchard Childress was actually the first person to tell me about that. And so I think, along with what Graham Hancock talks about, a period of amnesia, is that there was a high culture that lived around the world. The Ice Age ended. There was possibly a 3,000-year period of amnesia of people because of the devastating effects of a possible change in the tilt of the planet because of a meteor impact or a comet coming close by, according to the theories of Stephen Mailer and also Barbara Hahn Clow. And so civilization had to start again. And I think what we're looking at in Peru, Egypt, and Italy and other places is a very ancient, sophisticated culture that we are only starting to re-recognize today.
That's a good point. Now, is it possible it's much older than we think?
Well, you know, if you look at the time period that people like Graham Hancock and Barbara Hahn Clow were looking at, as in 11,500 BC or 11,500 years ago for this catastrophe to have happened,
yeah,
then then obviously you're looking at structures that were made by a sophisticated culture more than 12,000 years ago. How far back in time we can go, I'm hoping to find out to some degree with Chris and also Dr. Robert Schock in November, because he's coming down to join me and a megalithomania group from England to research that.
Well, that could be amazing. You know, in the old Indian texts, they talk about flying machines, Vermanas, that they were out there. I mean, this planet might have been loaded with high technology.
Exactly. And of course, what the archaeologist is saying is always, where are the tools? But what we're finding, again, thanks to people like Stephen Mailer, are seemingly components of tools in, for example, the Cairo Museum, where you have these amazing, almost perfectly circular discs made out of very thin schist stone. And they could be components of machines. And what I'm always telling people is, if any ancient machine existed that had anything of value, such as gold or silver, a later culture that wasn't as sophisticated would simply take those machines apart and recycle them.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Gosh, I would have loved to have lived in that era just for a moment, Brian, just to see what they were doing.
Well, exactly. And I think what we have to do is, that's why people keep saying laser, because most people are thinking in terms of the technology that we understand, but it's quite possible that a like ancient culture would have used a completely different mindset. So that's why different people are thinking now in terms of vibrational tools or sound tools, something of, you know, science fiction that we think of, but they could have actually existed.
Well, absolutely. And Chris, tell us a little bit about these measurements you took in Peru and your comparison to Egypt.
When I was there in 2005, my measurements were rather limited because of the range of tools that I took. But when I was going through Peru, the tools that I did have, which was a straight edge and a square, were quite adequate, and I did find some extremely flat surfaces in various locations, such as Ayantitambo. Not so much in Machu Picchu or Sacsayhuaman, but Ayantitambo did have some stones that were extremely flat. But it was very interesting. I had some other tools in my toolkit, but when we went to Bolivia and took a day trip out to Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, I had left most of them in my hotel because I didn't think I would need them. I thought that I would see just pretty much what I had seen previously, and so there were some tools that I left behind. That all kind of changed when I went to Pumapunku, and immediately I realized that I made a huge mistake, because there were artifacts that there's only way you could describe them, and that is that they were cut on a machine. Because of the precision of them, the geometry, and it's totally different, not at all like what I saw in Peru. So it was a very interesting story. We arrive at Pumapunku, Tiwanaku village, and we stay at the hotel Tiwanaku. Visited Pumapunku that afternoon, and then I hired a taxi driver to take me back to La Paz so that I could get the tools that I'd left behind and take some more measurements.
All right, but, with you two, we're going to take this break, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about this, including, of course, some of the lost technologies of Bolivia. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM with our guests Brian Forrester, Christopher Dunn on Coast to Coast AM.